Welcome to Built to Go, a van life podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Wagg, coming to you from the College of Curiosity. This time it's episode 222, and we're going to talk about 10 reasons to be joyful about van life. Yes, folks, it's easy to focus on what goes wrong, but let's talk about what goes right for a change. We're also going to talk about the Jackery 1500 in some depth, as I have one I can play with now. We're going to have a product review of USB-C PD plug adapters, which is way too many letters. And we're going to talk about a road trip to DC that didn't go quite as planned. Anyway, thank you very much for being with me here once again. And as is the pattern of late, I will be starting with a correction. Yes, folks, a few of you pointed out to me that last week I messed up about binoculars. You see, there are two numbers written on binoculars. There's a first number, which is magnification, and there's a second number, which is not field of view. It's actually how many millimeters the lens is. And I screwed that up, and I apologize. I have a little bit of a defense in that a pair of binoculars I have, the way it's notated on there, it actually says FOV, field of view, but if you look really closely, there's another number in front of that. So I apologize for getting that wrong. What you need to know, what matters for you, is that bigger lenses make for a better image. So you'll get more contrast, more depth. I mean, more light gets in the lens, it's better image. That's what matters. But if you're traveling, you may not want that bigger lens because that means you're going to have a bigger pair of binoculars. Again, for me, I like 8x42. You can try whatever you would like. And listener Brian pointed out to me that if we're going to talk about expensive binoculars, we might as well talk about really expensive binoculars, and that is stabilized binoculars. Yes, they make binoculars that have basically a little gyroscope in them, and it will stabilize the image. So if you're trying to see something from a moving vehicle, preferably not while you're driving, say a boat or your passenger in a van, or you want more magnification than you can reliably hold in your hands, because anything over 8 starts to get really shaky, you can get stabilized binoculars that they're magic. If you've ever looked through these things, it is like magic how much better they are than regular binoculars. But they're incredibly expensive. The Canon 10x30, for example, now again, 10 is bigger magnification, but 30 is smaller lenses, is $500. And that is an outlier in how the pricing is on these things. Most of the time, you're going to spend over $1,000 for a pair of stabilized binoculars. Now, if you're manning a fire watch or you're an avid birder or something like that, it may be worth it for you to go and get these really expensive binoculars. They even have one by Swarovski, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, that will identify birds, like directly in the binoculars. If you look at a bird, it'll tell you what bird it is. So there are a whole bunch of options for binoculars, but I've already talked about them too much. I regret the error, and I'm glad to have fixed it. And don't you worry, there will be more errors to come, I promise. But let's talk about 10 reasons to be joyful about van life. I mean, seriously, folks, podcasts like mine and on YouTube and all this, it's really easy to focus on the negative for a couple of reasons. One is that we're trying to solve problems. We're problem solvers here, and there are a lot of problems to solve in van life, and it makes sense to focus on that. But that, because they're problems, will tend to lend itself to being a bit more negative. The other reason is that people click on negative things, and while I am not trying to be clickbaity at all, a video that says 10 reasons van life sucks is going to get more views than a video that says 10 reasons van life is awesome. This week, 10 joyful things, and I hope you enjoy. Number one, there are more places to go than ever before in your van. There are more places you can go in your van. There's more roads than ever before. There are more places where your van will fit. And it doesn't always seem like that, but let's just look at national parks in the U.S. There are more national parks in the U.S. right now than there ever have been before. So there's more places to go. Now, yes, they can be crowded and all that, but remember, this is the joyfulness we're talking about here. So keep in mind that when things get difficult, they're still pretty good in this regard. Number two, there's more information than ever before. Never, ever could I have imagined that I would be able to access the sum of all human knowledge, which will help me build out a van and camp in. I mean, when I was a kid in the 70s, if you wanted information, you'd have to ask your parents. And I was the kind of kid that asked all kinds of questions that my parents would have no idea about because, you know, the questions I'm asking are like, why do insect legs bend in two places rather than three? And they're not entomologists. They're not going to know this. So they would say, well, go to the library. And you'd go to the library and you'd talk to the librarian and they would try to find you a book and it probably wasn't at your library, so you'd have to interlibrary loan it. And then you'd have this 500-page book that may or may not be within your reading level and you'd have to figure out what it says. And then that was it. That's all we had. That was life growing up in the 70s. And frankly, that was life growing up in every decade before that until you go far enough back that it was actually worse. Now, if I am curious as to what wire gauge I need to use if I have a 12-volt connection that's going to run 10 feet, I just type that into Google. And I imagine 5 years from now, AI is going to do all that for me. I just have to say a couple of keywords into something, and I will get a reliable answer back, which I don't think you get reliable answers from AI today, but I imagine in 5 years from now we will. So, folks, if you're a young person and you're building out your van and you find it difficult, it's so much easier now. Be joyful about how easy it is to get information about your van, because I, as an older person, am in awe of how easy it is. Number three, it's easier to stay connected. In the 70s, when there was the first big van life bubble that happened and everyone was making these custom vans with shag carpet and the funny windows on the side and all this, the only way to stay connected was with CB radios that had a range of a couple miles or so, depending on how it was rigged up. And that was it. If you wanted to communicate with other van life folks, and they didn't call it van life then, you had to just be lucky. You had to run into somebody on the side of the road or call them on the CB and maybe you could get a hold of them. I mean, at that time, people would actually write on the back of their vans what channel of the CB they were monitoring. 16 is apparently the official channel for van lifers and RVers. And that was it. There was no way you could go on the internet and look at a forum or go on Facebook and say, hey, van lifers, I'm going to be in Oregon in the next 20 days. Anything going on? And someone will say, yeah, you should come check out Descend on Bend. And it is so much easier now to connect with other van life folks than it has ever been in the entirety of human history. No question. Number four, it's much easier to have power in your van now. Again, back in the 70s, you basically had the starter battery, and that was it. And if you wanted to get real fancy, you could put another starter battery in the back, but there was no way to charge these other than to have what is called an isolator that would connect the front battery to the back battery in a one-way direction. Basically, power could go from the front battery to the back battery and not the other way. But there was no management or anything, and these were just plain old lead-acid batteries. They didn't have that much capacity. They were heavy. And all the appliances you had used a lot more power. Light bulbs used at least 10 times more power than they do now. And power was a huge concern. In fact, if you go to any of the RV museums, like the big one in Elkhart, Indiana, you will see that the older RVs had limited electric light. They mostly relied on propane inside the vehicles for light. You know, with those little mantles, some of which are radioactive, that's how they lit up the inside of their vans. And you can imagine what that would be like on a super hot, humid night to have one of those lights on, pumping out carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide, and a vast amount of heat along with that light. So the idea that we can just go get a Jackery and plug all our stuff into it and it works, and that includes a fridge and all your lights and your water pump and maybe even an instant pot, I mean, it's just amazing. Number five, heat and AC are accessible. Again, we can be off-grid and have heat and AC. Now, heat, that problem hasn't been that difficult. Propane heaters were very common, very easy to use, although they also use 12-volt power, which would be the problem with your heater. You typically wouldn't run out of propane, you'd run out of battery to power the fan in your heater. Now, with Chinese diesel heaters, You can basically have all the heat you want for very low cost. Yes, it uses 12 volts, but that problem was solved earlier. Now just a little bit of diesel will get you through an entire night and you'll be toasty warm. And the heater costs like $100. That is amazing. Now we're not quite there with AC yet. Nobody's going to go out and spend $100 for air conditioning and have it work in their van. But we are definitely improving. Even since when I started this podcast a few years ago, there has been a marked improvement in how accessible air conditioning is for vans, and that's only going to get better. So if you're building out a van and you have a sizable budget, you absolutely can have air conditioning in your van, at least for a few hours a day. That is something to be joyful of, and my hope is that 10 years from now, everyone will have air conditioning in their vans all the time. They won't even think about it. And they'll wonder about those dark days when nobody had air conditioning. Number six, living in a van now is becoming more and more like living in a house. And I mean that in the sense of convenience. You're giving up less and less to live in a van. Now, I've always said that the number one predictor of success for van life is how much you like camping. And I would use that as a test for people who are thinking about doing van life. If they come back and say, oh, I hate camping. Oh, it's so dirty. And I'm like, well, you know, van life is going to be tricky for you because it is a lot more like camping than living in a house. But that's getting to be less and less true. Once you can control your climate inside your van, everything else just kind of falls into place. Now, we still have the problem of, you know, when you flush the toilet, you're not done. You still need to deal with that you flushed, whereas at home, it's usually whisked away and you don't ever have to think about it again. That's not going to be a problem that's going to be solved anytime soon. But overall, you're going to be much more comfortable in a van now than ever before. And that's part of the reason why so many people are doing it. Number seven, and people might disagree with this one, the stigma is lessening. There is a stigma with living in a van. It's the same stigma that impacts homeless people. It's always going to be there. It's always going to be a problem. It's rooted in xenophobia and also in the fear that someone's life might change and they might have to live in a van one day and that's a horrible thought for them. All that kind of junk. But it's getting better. I receive many, many more positive comments about my vans and other vehicles I travel in than negative ones. Honestly, the most negative comments I've received have come from my mother. But the rest of the world is like, wow, you can do that? That's pretty cool. And that hasn't always been the case. The stigma comes and goes. In the 70s, it was probably less, and then it went way up in the 80s. You're living in a van down by the river. Remember that? That was like the epitome of rock bottom of your life. And now it's a goal for many people. So that's something to be happy about. If you like van life, you can do it with a lot less stigma than ever before. Number eight, YouTube. Whatever you want to say about it, YouTube is an amazing resource. And I think it's second only to Wikipedia. And they're different things. Obviously, Wikipedia is not going to be as helpful for your van, but they're two just incredible collections of human knowledge that we've never, ever had before. And just the thought that you can basically type in whatever vehicle you have into YouTube and then ask, like, how do I replace the alternator or what tires are best? And you will get videos of how to fix these things. I mean, that's just amazing. And it definitely is worth the time to take a step back and say, holy cow, look at what I can do here. I mean, I'm still blown away by YouTube. Number nine, cooking. We have so many cooking options in our vans now. It used to be that the only thing you had was the propane stove and maybe a propane oven that you could never really use because it would either make your van 1,000 degrees or it would burn whatever was in there. Now, you can use your propane oven and your propane stove, and you can also use your Instant Pot, and you can use your pressure cooker, and you can use a sous vide machine, and it is in my case, you can use your microwave or your air fryer. I mean, all these things are totally doable for not very much money in your van, which makes van life cooking so much easier and nicer. I mean, heck, I know people don't like Keurigs, but I have a Keurig I can use in my van if I want to. The simplest, easiest, mess-free way to make coffee, and I know a lot of people don't like it. I'm not going to get into that, but I couldn't have done that 20 years ago. It's a golden time for cooking in vans. And finally, number 10, one that I have not spent enough time on, but in my limited time I have spent with it, I have been incredibly impressed. It's how strong the van life communities are. Now, there's a lot of them, and they're varied. You've got the rubber tramp rendezvous folks. You've got the schoolie folks. There's the overlanding group. There's all these different communities, and then they all kind of mix together. And what I have observed is that they're all welcome at each other. If you show up at a schoolie event with a big overlanding rig, you're going to be welcome. If you show up at an overlanding event with a schoolie, you're still going to be welcome. It's a big, wide, open community. And if you are somebody who is worried that van life is going to be isolating, know that that is completely your choice. It doesn't have to be isolating. It can be joyous and filled with the richness of human experience if you want it to be. You can always find people to camp with if you want to. And again, this is not me. I'm usually the loner out there trying to get away from people as much as possible. But it doesn't have to be that way. And all these other things I've talked to have encouraged these communities to grow. And they are a true reason to be joyful about van life. So take a step back from all the negativity and all the problems and stuff. Grab your coffee, your tea, your kombucha, or whatever your drink of choice is. Have a look at the morning sunrise and say, wow, this is a great time to be alive. Because it is. Thank you very much to Kent for helping to keep this podcast ad-free. If you would like to help keep ads off of this podcast, please visit buymeacoffee.com/built-to-go. That's two T's, not three, not one. And you may buy me a gallon of diesel there, and that will help keep the ads off of this podcast. The support has been wonderful. Thank you to each and every one of you, especially those of you who give every month. Van life news. I need to come up with a way to say that. That's kind of iconic. I mean, well, we'll work on that. Anyway, van life news, interesting week. In Denmark, there has been some problems with van life, unfortunately. Apparently, not everybody in a van in Denmark is taking care of the environment. And the locals are getting upset, and now the government is regulating van life in parts of Denmark. And this is one of those things. Back to the stigma and thing. There are people who aren't going to like you just because you're in a van. It's going to happen anyway. So be good. Be a good citizen. If you're going to camp somewhere, follow Leave No Trace. Don't leave junk everywhere. All it takes is for one van out of 100 or even 1,000 to leave trash behind, and then all of us are labeled as, you know, malcontents who destroy the environment or whatever. So then what happens is the government steps in and restricts everybody, not just the people who are doing bad. And that's what they're doing in Denmark right now. They're restricting van parking in certain areas. They are creating designated van parking spots, which I think is a good step. And very interesting, they're starting an information campaign to explain to van life folks how they should behave in Denmark. I think that's a really good thing too. So this is a mixed bag. It's unfortunate that Denmark needs to respond, but the way they're responding actually seems pretty good. So try to be good and stay out of the news. Number two, this one's worth actually clicking on the link in the show notes. I have links in the show notes for all the news, of course. And the title of this, and it's from KAIT8.com, is Bear Destroys Family's Van on Camping Trip, Defecates Inside, quote, it stinks in there. So these folks were camping at Bass Lake in California, which is just south of Yosemite. They went on a hike and they're doing the Yosemite stuff, and they came back and they noticed there was somebody in their van, and they were like, what's going on? And then they realized It was a bear, and apparently the bear had been attracted to some pancakes and syrup that was left out on the counter and found a way into the van and then got stuck in there. And it couldn't get out, so it just basically tore the van apart and did what bears do, except this bear didn't happen to be in the woods, so it had to do its do in the van. And yeah, so the van is not in good shape. They survived, there's no injuries, and the bear ran off. And unfortunately, as they say, a fed bear is a dead bear, so these kind of things are bad for bears. You want to avoid any kind of thing that will attract bears to your camper. But yeah, it's not just the damage they do, it's sometimes it's what they leave behind. And this is this story. So I have been a detractor of the Ford Transit Trail since it first came out, because to me, they're just charging a whole lot of money for basically some stickers and bigger tires. And now the tires are gone. So basically what happened is the Ford Transit Trail came out and it's like, oh, this is the van that you want to make a camper van out of. And it came with these big tires. Arr! But they had a problem with rubbing, which is a very common problem when you add bigger tires to a van that wasn't designed for them. So they had all these complaints that the tires were rubbing. The people went to Ford and say, yo, what up? Let's fix this. So Ford has fixed it by putting on smaller tires. They basically are just putting on the regular tires that come with any Transit and saying, there you go, we fixed it. Aren't we good customer service people? Well, folks, the tires are a big part of what people were paying for the Transit Trail upgrade. And yeah, that's what Ford did. So I have a link to that whole story in the show notes from Gear Junkie. And yeah, bad move, Ford. You know, it wouldn't be very hard for you to actually build a van that was good for customizers, that had easy access to the power in the back and making everything more accessible, like having things be easier to unscrew and things like that, and then providing like a manual, which they do have, but it's hard to find, that explains where the good ground points are and things like that. That's the stuff we need. We don't need you to add more plastic flares and tires that don't actually fit the vehicle. So, big fail on Ford there. And yes, I still think the Ford Transit is the best van for van life at this point. Tech Talk. So I was gifted a Jackery 1500 Explorer. This is I think it's one version older model. This is a hefty Jackery. This thing weighs 35 pounds, and it's 127 amp hours. So this is enough to power any kind of smaller rig, like a minivan or a no-build. It's a good amount of power. It's a decent unit. I have always had a problem with the Jackeries because they have this handle that's permanent, and it takes up a lot of space, and it limits your build options. The newer ones don't have that, but this one does. And so I'm playing with this thing, learning about its capabilities. Very nice screen, very long-lasting output. And then I started looking into ways to charge it, because when you have a big battery, charging is the problem. So I notice immediately that it does not have any MC4 connectors. That is not uncommon with these power stations. It also doesn't have any Anderson connectors, which I'm a little disappointed at. All my other power stations have Anderson connectors. It just has barrel plugs, and that's it. It has two input barrel plugs, and that's how you get power into this unit. And that's the only option. Okay, that's fine. It comes with a massive brick that lets you charge the battery, and I think it said 4 hours, which is not bad for a battery this big. However, it's a 24-volt charger. So I figured out that what they did here was they have all the charging go through basically the solar controller. Power stations have a built-in solar controller. You can just hook up solar panels directly to them without a controller. That's one of the nice things. But I'm imagining, to save money and to make it more simple, this Jackery has everything go through that. So therefore, a 24-volt charger makes sense, because that's about the voltage that solar panels produce. And they're basically giving you this large brick to mimic the maximum capacity of solar panels that could go into this unit. Okay, that's fine. But what if you don't have that? What if you don't have access to an outlet, a 110-volt outlet? Well, okay, that's most of us. That's what we're doing, right? So then how do you charge it? Well, they have a cigarette plug charger, but that takes 10 hours to charge this thing. And it's because it's only a 10 amp output. Okay, well, what about solar? Yes, you can do solar. You're going to have to adapt it to exactly the right barrel plug. It did come with some barrel plugs that you can use, and you can because Jackery is such a popular brand, you can find them pretty easily. So you can do that too. But it's still going to take like 8 hours. So you might be thinking, like I'm thinking, is like, well, what about a battery-to-battery charger? I mean, that's the way to get the most amps into a battery the quickest. Yeah, no. I mean, you can do that. But it's not going to help you very much because the amperage rating on the charger is fairly low. And I don't actually have the number, and I'm sorry, I should. But if you do a battery-to-battery charger, it's going to be at 12 volts, unless you have a 24-volt system somehow. And then you're charging this Jackery with only 12 volts, and it's still going to be a lot less than the plug-in. So it's going to take forever to charge this thing is basically what I'm saying. When you're off the road. And I'm disappointed in that. I had hoped to find a way to charge this thing quickly because it has two inputs. And some Jackeries, you can actually give it two chargers. And I think you can still do that with this. I haven't tried plugging in the cigarette lighter and the solar yet. I will try that. But the bottom line is, this thing's going to take a really long time to charge. Now, I think the newer ones are better. But keep in mind that if you have an older Jackery power station that's of significant amp hours, it is going to take a really long time to charge, and you may find yourself on cloudy days not really having an adequate way to charge it. So, Jackery is a good brand, they make good stuff, they have good customer support, but make sure you understand how you're going to charge your power station before you choose one. There are other power stations on the market that let you get a full 40 amps out of a battery-to-battery charger, which is going to charge the thing much, much quicker. And if that's something you're interested in, make sure your power station has that. Product review. I mentioned this last week. I got an email about this amazing device that will turn USB-C PD, power delivery, the fancy USB-C, into barrel plugs and stuff so you can charge your laptop right from USB-C if you have enough power out of your USB-C. I've mentioned this many times. There's many different kinds of USB-C. They all look the same. They all are backwards compatible, basically, meaning that the higher end USB-C ports will still work with the lower end USB-C appliances. But this device will let you take up to 100 watts of power and send it through your USB-C. And that's a good amount of power. It's certainly enough to charge a laptop. My MacBook Pro actually uses a 120-watt charger. 100 watts is close enough. And I know from experience I can charge my MacBook Pro very, very slowly with any USB port. So that's easy. MacBook Pro and some PCs are easy because they have this all built in. What this thing is for is the type of laptop that has the more traditional barrel plug, like a ThinkBook or something like that, where you have to plug a brick in. And the idea is that you cannot use the brick. You can just use USB-C and save some space and complexity. Well, it's not great. Sorry to say. The person who wrote to me, and I'm very thankful to them. I've been talking with them. Their name's Michael. We've been talking back and forth about some other things. But so when you buy this thing, what you get is a fairly hefty USB-C cable that's not very long. And on one end of it, it has a female barrel plug that you basically can plug other barrel plugs into. And it comes with 20 of them. And the idea is that you'll find the right one that fits and then plug it into your cable. And boom, you can charge your computer or whatever with it. And I tried it with my laptop and the light came on. Bing, it's charging. Yay. And then I went into Windows and looked and said, sure enough, it's getting a charge. And I even waited to make sure the percentage changed. It absolutely charged my laptop. And then it didn't. And then it did. And then it didn't. It went beep, boop, beep, boop. It was an unstable connection. So I thought, okay, I must have the wrong barrel plug. So I tried some of the others and none of them made it any better. So why is that? Is it because it's the wrong barrel plug, or is it because it's not enough power? So I looked at the brick that came with my laptop, and it needs 140 watts. Now, needs isn't necessarily correct, but that's what the brick puts out. I'm limited to 100 watts with this thing. I did cheat a little bit and plug it into my Mac power brick, which sent 120 watts in. Now, I'm overloading the cables at this point. This is dumb. You don't want to do this, but I wanted to see what would happen. And the same thing happened. So, do I recommend this product? Well, I recommend this product if you know what you're getting into. For $25, this will let you charge nearly anything with USB-C. The voltage regulation is a little unclear to me. Now, I know that PD, that protocol for USB, will adjust voltage depending on what it's being asked for. But that requires a data connection. Like, your Mac will go to the USB-C charger and say, send me this much voltage. I don't see how that's happening with this. Also, there's no polarity. Barrel plugs have a positive and negative, and sometimes the inside's positive, sometimes the inside's negative, and you don't know, and I don't know, because this thing isn't labeled, and it is possible that you could put the correctly fitting barrel plug on this thing and then plug it into your laptop, but the polarity will be reversed, and if it's an older laptop, that might actually destroy it. So, to me, what I think this thing is good for is just to keep as an emergency, just in case you forgot your charger or you have some weird device and can't find the charger. This has a reasonably good chance of being able to charge it. But for long-term use or for something you're going to use every day, I don't think this is going to solve the problem. But again, it's only $25. Another issue with it is it's from one of these Chinese brands that no one's ever heard of before, and I think it's very interesting that there are no competitors that I could find from any name brand like Belkin or Anker or anything like that. So this is a hack. It's a cheat. It's not supported. I think you are possibly risking damaging something if you have an old piece of equipment that doesn't know how to talk PD. So if you're interested in this, make sure you understand that you need a PD, power delivery USB outlet, that's USB-C. Cars don't typically come with these. Some of the newer ones do, but usually that's not what you're going to find in a vehicle. This is something you're going to install yourself, or you're going to get an adapter for a cigarette lighter plug. Its maximum is 100 watts. Anything over that is dangerous. And whether the barrel plug fits and is the right polarity is a crapshoot. I don't know. Nothing is labeled. There's no guide. It's just a bunch of different barrel plugs, and you just plug and play and hope one works. So I'll have a link to this in the show notes. Caveat emptor. I think it's a great idea for a product, but I would really rather see it come from someone reputable like Anker. Tales from the road. So long ago. Was this in the 70s? This was in the 70s. That's almost 50 years ago. I took a big road trip to DC. This was the first time I traveled any distance without my parents. This was basically the eighth grade field trip. Now, going to school outside of Boston and Salem, Massachusetts, DC was the place that a lot of eighth graders went. It was about a day's drive, and, you know, it's DC. It's educational. So they loaded us up on the bus, and it was basically all the middle school kids, we didn't call it that, we called it junior high back then, that could afford to go on this trip. It wasn't free, you had to pay, from all the different schools in Salem, and we loaded into the bus and headed down to DC. And then things were not good. You know, one of the most important things you can do on a trip is, if you're organizing a trip or you're in any kind of leadership role, is to give people information. And we were given no information. We didn't know what we were doing from one moment to another. All the leaders could do the entire trip was to keep us from destroying everything we touched. When we got to the hotel, kids instantly started jumping up and down on the beds and running around, and there were just simply way too many kids for these parents who agreed to come with us, and we were terrible. We were so bad, in fact, that we ended up getting kicked out of the hotel. We had to go back home early. Embarrassing. But aside from that, we did see some cool stuff. And for a lot of these kids, this was their first time traveling. So their first time ever seeing stuff like this. And so for them, this was incredibly valuable. Unfortunately, again, with no information, we were seeing a lot of stuff we didn't understand. They took us to see the Declaration of Independence, which we knew what that was, but the significance of it was kind of lost. Like, there was no one to explain to us that this was not the Declaration of Independence. In fact, there is no the Declaration of Independence. There were many, many copies, and we were looking at one of them. They didn't explain the fact that this was not all signed in one day. It took months to sign. You know, we missed all the context of it, which is the kind of thing that drives me crazy. And then we went to the Air and Space Museum, where they just let us loose, and we tore through the place, and of course we had the most fun there. And then, the most embarrassing part is, we went to the Senate. Okay, that's fine. Actually, we went to the House of Representatives, not the Senate. We went to, it's the same building. We went to the Capitol. And they had us all line up on the stairs. And again, we don't know what's happening. We don't know what's going on. And this gentleman comes out in a suit and says, "Hi, kids, do you have lots of questions for me?" And we're like, "Who are you?" So in unison, like half of us, and there were probably 100 of us, were like, "Who are you?" And you could just see the look on his face that Nick Marvulis, this congressman from the House of Representatives, who had taken time out of his busy day to come see us, was a little disturbed that we had no idea who he was. And he was our congressman. And all right, later on he got charged with 15 counts of racketeering and served 15 months in prison. That aside, we totally had no idea we were going to meet with a congressman. All they had to do was tell us. And so he's there, "Hi, kids, so glad you could come to a wonderful city, you know, blah, blah, blah." And we didn't have any questions for him. We just wanted to get out of the hot sun and go somewhere cool again, like the Air and Space Museum. It was embarrassing. And again, first time traveling for lots of these kids, you know, I think I was like 11 or 12. I didn't have the proper mindset to appreciate everything. But one thing I did know is that we were sitting on the very stairs that the bill sat on from the Schoolhouse Rock series. If you remember, "I'm just a bill, I'm only a bill." That song, which, okay, I'm old, but you can YouTube it if you want. We were sitting on those stairs, and wow, wouldn't it have been useful to actually show us that video before we had this experience and explain to us that we're going to meet with their congressman and actually be able to talk to them? But of course, this was the 70s, and there was no way to do that. They would have had to have shown us actual film, which wasn't something that was going to happen. One last part of the story. As we're driving back, I learned a lesson about fellow kids and how not to trust them. Again, I didn't know a lot of these kids. They're from different schools. And we're riding back on the bus, and one of the kids I didn't know says, "Hey, put your hand on this rope up here." Now, this bus, even though it was a tour bus, had that rope that you can pull to stop the bus. I mean, Chicago buses still have this. When you're coming up to your stop, you pull on the rope and a little bell goes off and the driver knows to stop. This bus had one of those. And they said, "Hey, put your hand up on there. We're going to try something." And I'm like, okay, trying to be social and not understanding what was going on. I put my hand up there, and the moment I did, four other kids yanked on it as hard as they could and ripped the mechanism out of the bus. And then they all said, "Jeff did it." And I will never forget that. Ultimately, though, the joke was on them because their parents had to pay for the repairs to the bus. But that taught me something about human nature and how it's not always a good thing. And part of the reason I mentioned earlier that I like to be away from people is related to that incident. A place to visit. In Middlebury, Vermont, there is a college by the unusual name of Middlebury College. This is a very well-ranked institution. It is an excellent school, and it's in a beautiful part of the country. And if you are fortunate enough to go there, I'm very happy for you. And if you are fortunate enough to go there, you should know two things. Number one, it is the place where Quidditch was invented. No, not the Harry Potter game. The actual physical game that came out of the Harry Potter game, and I actually went to a match there, which basically consists of people running around with brooms between their legs trying to hit a ball. It was fascinating to see them try to interpret a game that heavily relied on flying for a land-based sport. But there were Quidditch leagues for a while, and that started in Middlebury College. I don't know if that's still going on. But that wasn't the only thing that Middlebury College invented. If you look around campus carefully, you will find a life-size bronze statue of a Great Dane jumping in the air. And in the Great Dane's mouth is a Frisbee. Because Middlebury College is one of two schools that claims to have invented the game of Frisbee. But of course, there's a story here. For the record, the other school is Yale. They have competing stories, but the origins are very similar. Now, I'm sure all of you are familiar with Frisbees. You know it's a trademark of the Whammo Company or whoever bought them. Same company that invented hula hoops. And the story is that a traveling salesman was traveling to Middlebury and went on campus and saw kids in the snow, actually, throwing all these objects around and trying to catch them. And what they were throwing were pie plates. Now, back in the day, the cafeteria would get orders of pies in these tin plates. And the plates were reusable because it was the days before plastic. This is over 100 years ago. And they would return the plates. So behind the dining hall, there was this big stack of tin plates, tin pie pans. And kids being kids, they would grab them and they realized that they were shaped perfectly for throwing and that they would fly through the air. And so the kids invented a few games like catch and stuff. This is long before Ultimate Frisbee. But the salesman saw this and thought, I wonder. And time went by, and then came plastic injection molding technology that made it inexpensive to make basically any shape you wanted out of plastic. And he thought, I could make those pie plates out of this plastic and sell them. And he invented what was called... the Pluto Platter, actually. He called it the Pluto Platter. But the kids called them Frisbees. Why? Because the pies came from the Frisbee Pie Company. Mrs. Frisbee was the person who came up with these pies and this whole system of distribution. Now, the Pluto Platter wasn't a success, but Whammo bought the patent and did all the necessary marketing and then renamed it Frisbee. Spelled differently. It's not exactly the same as the baker's name because, hey, we don't want to have to pay her any royalties. But yeah, that's where Frisbees came from. That's at least one of the legends. And that's why the statue is on the Middlebury College campus of a Great Dane with a Frisbee in its mouth. So if you're ever in the center of Vermont, a beautiful part of the country, definitely a place to stop if you're on your way to Burlington, whatever, it's really easy to go by Middlebury. Take a walk around the beautiful campus and find the statue of the Great Dane and realize that you're standing on the very ground where people used to throw pie plates at each other. Because, you know, why not? I'll have a link in the show notes in case you want to find the exact spot. Resource recommendation. Podcast is getting a bit long here, but let me just say that Sherm, thank you, Sherm. Sherm heard me talk about how In the last episode, I can't remember what, we were talking about vans and the most recommended van types, and the Vanagon came up, which is the Volkswagen camper van. And I mentioned that they're still very popular, but getting parts is hard. And he said, oh, wait a minute, sir. He has links to all these different places that will help you get parts for your old bus. And so I thought I would share them with you. Since he's done the work, you might as well reap the rewards. And I'll have this full list in the show notes. But very quickly, vancafe.com, busdepot.com, jbugs.com, westcoastmetric.com, wolfsburgwest.com, buslab.com, gowesty.com, and heritageparts.re.com. Those are many of the different places that you can get parts if you are doing the old Volkswagen thing. Again, full list in the show notes. And thank you, Sherm, for replying those resources. I know you're going to help somebody out who's got a 1974 Sunbus and is looking for the bolts to the seat or some other part that you'd think would be common, but just ain't. Well, folks, thank you very much for listening to episode 222. If you need to get a hold of me for any reason, I am Jeff at builttogo.com. That's two T's, not three, not one. Music, as always, is by Simon Wagg. Oh, and those of you wondering about jury duty, yeah, I never even got in the courtroom. They sent me home. Until next time, remember the words of Tim Cook. Let your joy be in your journey, not in some distant goal.